Okay. Are people able to hear me? All right. Excellent. Very good. So first of all, I want to greet everybody. I see that we have a number of Zoom participants. We have a lot of people who are here in Gross in person. And I'm especially gratified to be able to give this shiur as well in the presence of my mother, who I believe will be joining us shortly on Zoom. She's not able to join in person this year, but we're very, very grateful and thankful that Baruch Hashem, she's able to join by Zoom, and look forward to her to seeing her name, God willing, soon. And of course, my family is represented as well in person by my nephew Ariel Walicki, by my cousins David and Rina Bunin. So thank you all for coming, as well as many of the Banim Chashuvim, Rabbi Miller, Rabbi Mann, Rabbi Lerner, and others whom I see are present, Rabbi Eisenberg. It's really a tremendous schus to have you all commemorate the 15th yahrzeit of my father, Tzvi ben Ephraim HaKohen, Zichrono Levracha. So the topic that I chose to speak about this year is the topic of self-driving cars and halacha. It is appropriate really for Parashas Maaseh, which speaks about some of the laws of Resicha, and also speaks about the notion of Hatzolah, even in the context of Ritzilu Ha'edes HaRotzeach, that there's a notion that we want to avoid killing people as much as possible, even a Rotzeach, and to engage in Hatzolah. Sometimes there's a tension that exists between the requirement for Hatzolah on the one hand and the prohibition against the Ritzicha on the other hand. This is the most pointedly true, as we know, in the case of the Rodef, that there's a mitzvah that if somebody is in danger of being killed by a pursuer, by a Rodef, who would be assailant, that wants to kill a particular person. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, the Afayin Gimel, derives of Hekesh between the case of Roseach and the case of Nara Murasa, a betrothed woman who is about to be raped. Ve'ein Moshiyala, Hayesh Moshiyala, B'chol Dava Shiyachol Hoshiyah, says she can't be saved, which means that if she can be saved, then you have to use everything at your disposal to try to save her. And there's a hekesh in the pasuk that says in Devarim ki kashir yakum ishel reyeu ritzachon nefesh kein hadavar hazeh, that case is compared to the case of a roseach. So we see that in order to save somebody from being murdered, you're allowed to disable the would-be murderer, and if it's necessary, to kill the would-be murderer in the process. So then that act of killing that would normally be a ma'aseh ritzicha ends up being not only permissible, but it ends up being a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah of hatzalah. Of course, the halacha, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Mem Tes points out, that if you're able to disable the would-be murderer by disabling the murderer be'echad me'evarav, by just breaking off his leg, and as a result, he won't be able to run after his would-be victim anymore and kill the victim, so then you have an obligation to do so. Not only do you have an obligation to do so, but the Gemara points out, and the Rambam Paskins, that if you could have disabled the would-be murderer by simply striking him be'echad me'evarav, by causing him to be disabled or to lose his leg or his arm, and instead you decided to kill him, so then that act of saving the would-be victim becomes not an act of a ma'isa hatzalah anymore, but becomes an act of ritzicha. And in fact, such an individual would be hareze shofech damim b'chayev misa, in the words of the Rambam in Hilchos Rotzeach, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yud Gimel, just based on a technicality, in bezdin memisino. So we don't put the person who is the rescuer to death in that situation. The Evan Ozel explains that even though from the sugya and the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it sounds like Avner, who put Asael to death when Asael was pursuing him, And he really could have just disabled him. Be'echen me'evar was chayev misa b'dei Sanhedrin. That's the mashmos of the sugya. He says that's because, and therefore it was justified for Yoav to have killed Abner, who is the brother. Yoav was the brother of Asael, of course. And he says that case was different because Abner went out of his way to murder Abner when it would have been Abner went out of his way to murder Asael when it would have been easy for Abner, who was an expert marksman, to simply have disabled him, but because he specifically didn't act to murder him, when it wouldn't have been hard for him to figure out how to disable him much more easily and in a less fatal fashion. Therefore, that's why he may have been chayav misa in the hands of Beis Din. But for your average person who has a hard time when they're trying to prevent a murderer from killing, has a hard time making the calculation of exactly how to disable them with one limb as opposed to killing them. So even though it is considered to be a ma'aser ritzicha, Beis Din does not punish them as harshly in terms of making that calculation to determine that the person really had murderous intent. And that's the reason we don't put the person to death. But nonetheless, it is considered, objectively speaking, to be a ma'aser ritzicha. So we see from here kind of this very difficult tension that the halacha creates and requires us to be cognizant of between when it is that engaging in an act of killing is considered to be an act of saving, an act of hatzala, and when it's considered to be a ma'aser ritzicha. So these types of calculations and questions have come up in recent years with the advent of this creation of autonomous self-driving vehicles, because first of all, it's a scary thing for most of us to think of cars that, like a headless horseman, that doesn't have any human being that is really watching over it and making all the appropriate twists and turns and reactions on the road, and it's just kind of driving itself. You should know that people were similarly apprehensive in the early 20th century when they came up with the idea of self-driving elevators. That everybody was so used to there being an elevator attendant and that would securely take them from one floor to the next. Some may remember even every now and then you'll see a 130-year-old elevator attendant. But it's a general rule. You don't have it so much anymore. Some of you may remember in your youth that they still had, you know, such things like, you know, the bathroom attendants or the elevator attendants. You still have it in the subway station in Washington Heights on 181st Street. So there still is some sort of a remnant of that idea, but people were really scared about elevators that would just drive by themselves. Now, of course, we understand that elevators that operate by themselves, that we feel, you know, perfectly safe about. Maybe we feel, you know, a little bit more scared if there's a strange looking elevator attendant. It could be that the apprehension that people have right now with self-driving cars is similarly misplaced, because perhaps the only thing scarier than a self-driving car is a car that's being driven by a human. As we know that the cars that are on the road right now cause, according to statistics, approximately 1.25 million people are killed on the average on the road in traffic accidents all over the world every single year. There's a very fine paper that was written by Rabbi Moiz Navon, who's the founding engineer of Mobileye, considered the rabbi of Mobileye. He was very gracious. I was in touch with him before the shir. He shared with me a paper that he wrote on this subject, in which he shared this particular statistic. And according to many of the tests that various companies have performed together with the regulators and scientists and technicians, they have determined that the self-driving cars, if appropriately regulated, will be able to prevent virtually all of those accidents. Virtually all of those accidents it could save really well over a million lives every single year. Now, when you have self-driving cars, there are, of course, different degrees. There are different levels of self-driving cars. You have one level where, which we call simply hands-off, which many cars right now have features of cruise control and the like. where you don't necessarily have to keep your hands on the wheel all the time. But I mean, depending on exactly how the model is built, but you have to keep your hands nearby. And if there is any twist on the road or, you know, something changes in the road conditions, so then you'll have to make the appropriate adjustment as the case may be. When we speak about the self-driving cars of this discussion, we're speaking about self-driving cars that are more in the realm of what we call eyes off, not just hands off, but where you can be text messaging something you're not supposed to do right now. Right now, we call it distracted driving. We really have self-driving cars all the time because people are texting when they're driving and, you know, doing these things anyway. But the problem is that the cars haven't gotten the memo that they're supposed to be self-driving, which is what leads to lots and lots of accidents. But with this type of a model of a self-driving car, you will have people with the ability to text and to watch programs or, you know, whatever else they're doing, keep their eyes off of the road. And sometimes if there is some type of a situation that the car hasn't been programmed for, it will be able to anticipate that this situation is arising up ahead. And there'll be a very sweet voice that will speak to you, kind of like, you know, the GPS lady. There'll be a very sweet voice that will say, oh, you do have to, you know, attend to the road right now, and you'll have to make a decision in about 30 seconds or something like that. So there'll be a sufficient notice that the person will be able to take the reins and to deal with the situation as appropriate. Then there's what we call the next level of self-driving cars, which is also a possibility. There was Knesset legislation that was passed in March of this year, of 2022, that would allow for such cars to be on the road in Israel if such technology could be perfected. And that is the type of car which would be minds off, where you not only do you have to keep your, is it okay if your eyes are off the road, but your mind can be off the road. You could be taking a nap. You could just not be paying any attention at all. And the car will do everything. The only limitation with respect to the minds off model of the self-driving cars right now is that it would only work within a certain geographic limits of areas that have been sufficiently tested out, where there are no untoward type of surprises that might suddenly occur. You couldn't have this type of a vehicle in a very busy urban downtown type of setting, certainly not in Muncie or Borough Park. You couldn't have, you know, a car in a sort of a complicated area where people can jump out in all kinds of ways and directions at any point in time, and baby carriages and small children and what have you. It would be more an area that was deemed to be more controlled and with more clearer road boundaries and the like. But that is also a possible model that we're speaking about. Now, there have been certain places where these types of cars have been tested. There were certain models, such as a car that was developed by Mercedes-Benz that was allowed to operate in this particular fashion. And also Waymo. Waymo was originally a Google enterprise that was very interested in this idea of self-driving cars. Eventually, they spun off to develop this self-standing company called Waymo, and they became the first service provider making these types of cars available, taxi rides to the general public in certain areas, certain geographical areas, starting 2020. There really haven't been. In the very small statistical sample that we have thus far, there haven't been too many fatal accidents. There was one where the mechanism didn't detect a very light-colored tractor trailer that was turning around the road. It wasn't in its vision, and the skyline was itself very bright at that point in time, so that the car's technology was not able to detect the tractor trailer, and it did not lead to good things. That was one case, and there was another case where there was a pedestrian that ran into the road with a Tesla vehicle, a Tesla semi self-driving vehicle, where there unfortunately was a fatality. And it also raised the question whether under normal circumstances, had it not been a self-driving car, whether the driver of the vehicle would have anyway had really the wherewithal to have swerved out of the way from this pedestrian without causing danger to the driver. And it raises all kinds of ethical issues. There probably will be some cases, like the tractor trailer case, where If not for the self-driving car technology, if you had a regular human driver behind the wheel, you might be a little bit safer. But in the vast majority of cases, the self-driving car is going to end up being safer. So do we say that this is a good thing or a bad thing or maybe even a mandatory thing from the perspective of halacha? So you have to realize, from the perspective of halacha, there's not only a mitzvah to rescue somebody when they're in danger, like the person who's about to be murdered, but it actually is something that is a mandatory act, meaning it's not only a good deed to do it, but we have an affirmative obligation to go out of our way to save people. In the secular world, for example, if you see that somebody is being stabbed to death, you don't have an affirmative obligation to save them. There is no such law. We speak about the Good Samaritan laws. The Good Samaritan laws, I mean, the Samaritans weren't actually so good, but what's called the Good Samaritan laws that were enacted, for example, in the United States, they were devised, I think, in reaction to a certain incident that occurred in New York City, I believe it was, with a woman named Kitty Genovese, who was stabbed to death outside of a building, and she was screaming and screaming, and the apartment dwellers kind of, you know, maybe they opened their blinds, maybe they closed their blinds because they were annoyed by it. They didn't intervene. They didn't call for help. They didn't try to rescue her from her assailant, and she was bludgeoned to death. People said this is a horrific thing. So as a result, the reaction were these Good Samaritan laws, but the laws didn't say that the apartment dwellers or anybody else for that matter would have an affirmative obligation to rescue her or anybody else from their assailant, but rather simply said that if somebody did try to rescue and then they caused some harm inadvertently in the process, so they would be protected from liability. That's the nature of the laws. But in halacha, we have a law of lo samar al damriyecha. Lo samar al damriyecha, not to stand idly by your neighbor's blood, stands for the proposition that we have an affirmative obligation, even if it means, the Gemara says, there's generally an obligation of hashivosa lo, you're supposed to return lost objects. You certainly should return a person to their health. But it means you have to go out of your way. If you have to rescue the person through hiring emergency personnel, somebody is drowning and you can't save the person. You can't jump in yourself because you don't know how to swim and you're not a good swimmer, but you have the ability to hire somebody or call the Coast Guard where they have the ability to jump in, even if it's going to cost some money. And you might not get reimbursed. Nonetheless, you have an obligation to do so, to rent to the emergency workers to save this individual. And Rashi has a very interesting comment in which he explains exactly what the pasuk is teaching us. Rashi says, "Kamashma lan lo samar al damayecha, lo samar al atzman, don't stand by yourselves, mashma, ela chazu al kol atzdadin, kidei shlo ya'abe damayecha." Rather, you have to go out of your way to look for every single possible avenue in which you can rescue somebody. You have to think of avenues to rescue an individual. I would submit, by extension, a society has to think of avenues in which they can make lives safer. It's either way that you have to think of ways in which you can make lives safer for the individuals in society. What are going to be the optimal safety, security provisions that you can provide? If you think about the Rambam's idea, as explained by Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, by the Evan Ozil, who said that if you have the ability to save somebody, we said to save a victim by disabling the murder, and you lo torach b'kach, and you didn't exert the extra effort, but instead you killed the person when you really could have done less than killing the person. So then, strictly speaking, says the Rabbim, it's an act of ritzicha, and the person is chayev misa. So if you think about it from a society planning perspective, if you have a job to ensure the well-being, the safety of all the individuals in the community, all the individuals under your jurisdiction, and you make certain rules, certain traffic rules, you have certain vehicles that you allow, and certain vehicles that you don't allow. But on the whole, you did a sloppy job in terms of the traffic rules. Had you thought about it, had you exerted a little bit more tiocha, had you worked harder, then you would have been able to save more lives. But because of the fact that you did a sloppy job, you didn't think things through fully or carefully enough, as a result, more people are going to get killed. What if you think about it, that might really run into sort of, at least from a hashkafic perspective, from a conceptual perspective, really run afoul of the Rambam's mandate and run afoul of what Rashi is describing in terms of the affirmative obligation of l'samano damriecha, chazor al kol etzdadin, that you have to look at all of the different angles, look at all of the different avenues. There's a discussion with respect to suicide. With respect to we know there's a prohibition. A person is not allowed to kill himself. That's not such a chiddush. We know v'achas timchem and the danaf shosechem edrosh pasuk in Bereishis. You're not allowed to kill yourself. The prohibition of lotirtzach, according to the medrash and the halachos ketanos, says lotirtzach includes lotitratzeach, that you can't kill others. You're not allowed to kill yourself. So there's a famous question. Are you allowed to put yourself in a suffix sakana? Are you obligated to put yourself in a suffix sakana to endanger yourself? It's a risk. You don't know for sure that you're going to kill yourself, but you're putting yourself in a suffix sakana in order to save somebody else. According to the Yerushalmi, there is such an obligation, but it's not recorded in the Shulchan Aruch. And the Sma says that it's not recorded in the Shulchan Aruch because it seems that we don't paskin that way. The Rif and the Rambam don't record this halacha of the Yerushalmi. We don't paskin that way. That there seems to be a machlokis between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi based on a Gemara Maseches Nida. According to the Bavli, you're not obligated to put yourself in a suffix sakana in order to save somebody else. If you can save somebody without endangering yourself, then you have an affirmative obligation to do so. Once again, you have to engage in this type of a balance. So the Piskei Tshuva quotes from the Radbaz that if you do decide that you're going to put yourself in serious peril, you don't know how to swim. You're hoping that maybe you'll figure it out in the 5 seconds that you're going to jump in right now and try to save somebody who's drowning, but you don't really know what you're doing. So you're putting yourself in very serious peril. So if you do such a thing, he says, not only do we not to tell you that you're obligated to do so, but we don't even give you brownie points. Hareza chasid shota, we call you an absolute moron. We call you an idiot for doing such a thing. This fake the day odif mi vaday de chavre, because if you're going to put yourself into serious danger, so that also is something that the Torah forbids you from doing on some level. That's how the Tzitz Eliezer understands what he's saying, that it could be there's an actual prohibition. Just like you're not allowed to be misakin others, you're not allowed to endanger others, you're not allowed to endanger yourself. Now, the Piskei Tshuva quotes from the Agudas Ezov that you're not supposed to overanalyze this. Ulam tzarech lishko ha'inyan heitev, im yesh bo suffix akonim l'daktek b'yoyser. You're not supposed to say, oh, well, if I jump into the water, I'm a great swimmer, but maybe I'll scratch my finger. If I scratch my finger, maybe I'll bleed. If I bleed, maybe I'll get an infection. If I get an infection, maybe it'll get worse. I'll get a staph infection in the hospital. Who knows? In a week, you know, it could all be over for me. So that is so far-fetched that you're not allowed to engage in that type of calculation. If it's a very small risk, so then you do have an affirmative obligation. But you have to engage also, even when it comes to self-preservation in this type of a cheshbon, that if it's really an act of hatzol of saving somebody else, you have an obligation to do so. But if it's really an act where you're simply putting yourself in danger, you're very unlikely to save somebody else, but you are likely to put an end to your own life, so then it can actually be a prohibition. Some say, okay, maybe it's permitted. There seem to be some riots. Two people are in danger that they're both going to be killed by an evil kingdom. And if one of them comes, the Sefer Hasidim says, that some marauders that come around, they say, we're going to kill one of the two of you. And one of them volunteers and says, it's okay, you can kill me and not the other person. So that would seem to be akasha. But you can argue that this is a little bit different. The Mincha Shlomo Zalman Orbach says, that's a case where your life is already, you know, in danger. Your life is already in danger. You could say, okay, take me and not to the other person because the other person is a bigot. Your life is not in danger, he says, so you don't have the right to automatically to do such a thing. Linus Upapus, in the famous story in Maseches Tainus, there was a decree from the evil government, Roman government, that said that we're going to kill everybody because we think that somebody, you know, poisoned the princess. So we from the Jewish community, so we're going to kill everybody in the Jewish community. And they volunteered and said, no, it was us. Just kill us. And was told that in the place that they have in heaven, that nobody else will be able to attain their high place in heaven. Why? They were giving themselves up. So maybe you can give yourself up when, as I said, similar to the case where you have the marauders who say, we're going to kill one of you. So they would have been killed anyway, because the whole Jewish population was going to be killed. Or maybe when you're saving the entire Jewish population, that's a different story. Or maybe if there is a war against all of the Jews and it's a wartime situation. So wartime situations are anyway subject to totally different cheshbonos in terms of morale building, in terms of, you know, saving the community from the enemy, a totally different type of cheshbon, of a different analysis. But as a general rule, when a person does end up in this sort of a self-preservation setting, you do have this type of a cheshbon, you do have this type of a calculus that has to be made. By the way, this is very relevant to the whole idea of vaccinations. You have vaccinations that can really save people's lives. It's very hard to speak about vaccinations because people have very strong feelings about the subject. And whatever you say, you're going to be very offensive to at least, you know, a certain segment of the population. So I apologize ahead of time. Understand this to be a fully theoretical discussion. If such a thing exists, I'm not saying it never happened, but if you did have a vaccination that was effective, I don't know what there was. They say that the vaccination stopped polio, but maybe that's what they say. If you did have vaccinations that were effective, let's say against polio, let's say against measles, let's say even against corona, let's say that it could, such a thing could be proven, that you had vaccinations that were effective and it was it would save hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people from death. You still look at the people before the vaccination who got sick and died and the people after the vaccination. It seems this is, you know, working very, very well. So you have a little bit of a concern. Oh, but maybe you might have a very small percentage of cases where a person who wouldn't have gotten ill otherwise will get ill and die as a result of the vaccination, maybe 1 in 1 million or something like that. So the Tiferes Yisrael and the Mishnayos Maseches Yuma says with respect to smallpox vaccination, he said it's perfectly legitimate and appropriate to take the vaccination, even if 1 out of 1,000 people would die. Why is that? Because the vaccinations we have today are much better than the vaccinations where 1 out of 1,000 people would die. If you have a vaccination where nobody dies, or 1 out of 1 million, so that's a much, much better statistic. They said if you have 1 out of 1,000, so the number of people who are dying from smallpox, especially the small children, is much, much more than 1 out of 1,000. So therefore, he said that of course, you should choose the sakana rechoka over the sakana karova, that this would be a perfectly legitimate thing to do. And he lauded the non-Jew, who created the smallpox vaccine, as one of the Chasidei Umos HaOlam, that this was considered to be a very good thing. So here too, it's not just sort of an optional calculation. If you really make the determination that the vaccinations are going to save lives, and particularly, and again, I'm not arguing the science of any particular vaccination, but if it could be shown that a herd immunity would be created by more people being vaccinated. So as a result of individuals deciding not to vaccinate, they're not only harming themselves, but they're harming their neighbor, because now their neighbors, now other people are more likely to get sick and die because of the fact that you're not helping out in terms of creating that herd immunity. So this would also seem to fall, arguably, within this obligation of Rashi, of Chayeb Lachso, I'll call it Studen, Kadesh Lo Yabi Dam Reyecha, that there is something that you can do without creating danger to others, without creating danger, undue danger to yourself, and it's going to save other people who might otherwise be in greater danger if you don't take these steps. So it could be that you have a real affirmative obligation to engage in these types of actions. These are, you know, the types of fine-tuned distinctions you have to make. So if you get back to a sort of the automated vehicle question. So if you come to the conclusion based on the scientific tests and so forth, that every single person is going to be better off with the self-driving cars, it would seem that this is something that as a society, we should very much encourage bringing into our roadways. Just like planes, people, you know, generally planes, whether you feel safe on a plane or not, I'm the type of person, I feel safer if I know I'm driving the vehicle. So I feel safe, like the plane, like, you know, I don't, you know, somebody else is driving the vehicle. But planes, too, the truth is they drive themselves. They fly themselves for the most part nowadays, and they're actually much safer than cars. If we come to the conclusion it's really going to be safer, you'll say, oh, but there are a couple of types of weird, quirky things that will happen that wouldn't have happened otherwise. But if there's no particular person who's targeted, per se, with respect to that type of a danger, so then they can't really say, no particular person can say, this is going to be more dangerous for myself. Maybe a person will say, but I'm such a good driver. I'm such an amazing defensive driver. I watched all the videos. I don't have to pay high insurance because, you know, I know defensive driving inside out. And I would definitely be better off if I'm behind the vehicle as opposed to if there would be self-driving cars. So the truth is, I don't think anybody can really say that, because no matter how good a driver a person is, we're all susceptible to people who are talking on their cell phones, people who are texting while they're driving, people who are drunk driving. And even if you're an excellent driver, you're susceptible to, chas v'shalom, being harmed by those individuals in a way in which you're not going to be if we're dealing with the self-driving car type of situation. In addition to this sort of general question of, so maybe it's a good thing to have the self-driving cars, but how do you program the self-driving cars? And this is where you have certain very interesting ethical issues that arise. Obviously, you program the self-driving car that if there is a car that stopped ahead, so you'll slow down this vehicle and it won't go into the other car, and you'll prevent collisions, things of that variety. But sometimes the choices don't really allow you to escape danger altogether. For example, you have the old trolley problem question. What's the trolley problem? Trolley problem was a dilemma that was articulated by a philosopher, I think a British philosopher. Her name was Philippa Foot, and this was in the 1960s. She came up with the following dilemma. You have a trolley. Nobody knows what a trolley is anymore, but whatever. Okay, it's a trolley, a train of some sort. There's a driver of a train. The driver of the train is driving along the tracks, and suddenly they see that there are five people who are standing there in the middle of the tracks. Doesn't want to kill those five people, isn't able to put the pedal on the brakes. That's not an option, no time to do that. And these people are definitely going to die if the trolley barrels into them. So what does the person do? There's another track, so he can divert the trolley. This would be an affirmative action. He's diverting the trolley. The trolley is going to go on an alternative set of tracks. But there's one other person who's working. He's working on those tracks. He's, you know, saying, I've been working on the railroad. Whatever, he's working, you know, fixing up the tracks. And if you swerve in that direction, that person is going to get killed. And presumably, there's no, you know, screaming, watch out, you know, type of solution in this situation for whatever reason. So you have to make a choice. Do you just allow the train to continue along its normal course and kill the five people? Or do you take an affirmative measure in order to swerve in the other direction and kill one person? So Philippa Foot wrote that she assumes that most people would adopt the view that, of course, you try to kill the fewest number of people. The trolley driver presumably is not at fault for whatever reason himself or herself. And therefore, you try to adopt a solution that we call this the utilitarian approach. Utilitarian approach to try to preserve the most lives. On the other hand, if the trolley driver did nothing, you can argue the trolley driver is just completely passive in this, isn't committing an act of murder. But the trolley driver makes an affirmative decision. I'm going to divert the train in the other direction. This other person was completely safe beforehand, and now I'm going to swerve and kill the person. So you can argue that's an act of ritzicha. And we should never allow murder under any circumstances, even if fewer people are going to get killed. That's called the deontological approach. Deontological, you know, stands for the notion of deon, a Greek word, meaning duty. You have a certain duty that you're not allowed to take an affirmative action in order to kill somebody. So what does the halacha have to say about the trolley problem? Well, it says, look in the Chazon Ish. That's what the halacha says. Because the Chazon Ish, a good, I don't know, 40 years maybe before Philippa Foot, she did give him attribution, but I'll assume she didn't look at the Chazon Ish. So the Chazon Ish really had the same sort of dilemma, slightly different context, not dealing with the driver himself. So in that sense, it's a little bit different. But the Chazon Ish dealt with the arrow case. There's an arrow. I don't know. This is a very powerful arrow. It didn't explain. It's a theoretical case. So you have to assume an arrow can do whatever the arrow did in his example. You have an arrow which is flying along, and the arrow is about to go. I don't know how the arrow is going to, you know, accomplish this, but the arrow is about to go into five people at once. That's what he says. The arrow is about to go. It's a very, very powerful arrow. It's like a missile. It's a missile. The missile is about to go into five people, and it's about to kill those. It's about to kill those five people. So what do you do in that particular case? If you have the ability to stop the arrow, we have the ability to stop the arrow. So obviously, stop the arrow. But the Chazon Ish says that you only have this type of an option that you can deflect the arrow. You can't stop the arrow entirely. Let's assume that we're dealing with a situation where you can only deflect the arrow, but in the event that you deflected the arrow, then the arrow is going to end up going in a different direction where it's going to definitely kill one individual. It's not a question mark as to whether it's going to kill one person, but it's most definitely going to kill one person. The Chazon Ish is located in Sanhedrin Simon Chapei, if you want to take a look at the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish says that I have a real suffix about this, because you can argue maybe this is a case of a Maisa Hatzolo, that it's not a Maisa Ritzicha. I'm trying to prevent the five people from being killed, and to do so, I deflect the arrow. So it happens the arrow is going to go into one person, but I'm not really doing a Maisa Ritzicha. He contrasts this with the case of the Yerushalmi and Trumos. Yerushalmi and Trumos talks about case, famous case, Paskin and the Rambam, Paskin and Shulchan Aruch, that you have a bunch of, again, marauders, we'll call them, who come along and they say to the Jews of a particular city, give over one of you guys, and if not, we're going to kill everybody in the city. You give over one person, you not give over one person. The halach is, you don't give over the one person, despite the fact that the entire city is go all the Jews, including the way that most of the Mefarshim explain, including the person you would have given over. Everybody's going to get killed anyway. Nonetheless, you're not allowed to turn over that individual. Why is that? Says the Chazon Ish, the turning over that individual, that's considered to be a Maaser Tzika. Not only that, but let's say they were Miyachid, a particular individual. Say you have a Machlokas, Rabbi Yochanan, Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan says, well, if they designate a particular individual, fine, so you give over that individual. Reish Lakish says, even if they designate an individual, you don't give over that individual, unless that person was Chayav Misa anyway, like Sheva ben Bichri. Sheva ben Bichri, figure in Tanakh, he was Moed B'malchus, and so sold the David HaMelech, supported the rebels of the Avsholom, revolt against him. And therefore, he was Chayav Misa, and David's generals went to get him, and a wise woman, I think it was supposed to be Sarah Kwanos Basosher, told the people in her city that better, you know, dispose of Sheva ben Bichri rather than have everybody, you know, in the city get killed. So Sheva ben Bichri is an example. He was Chayav Misa anyway. Chayav Misa. So if the person who is designated is Chayav Misa, so then you hand over that person. Otherwise, you don't hand over that person. And the Rambam, interestingly, Paskins like Reish Lakish, the Rambam Paskins, even if they designate an individual, that person's not Chayav Misa, Kesher and Mikri, you don't turn them over. Kasha is that the Gemara says is a normal case. Rava was presented with the following Shaila. Somebody came to him and said that I have an evil governor where I live. This person says that he has an individual that he wants me to whack. He wants me to be a hitman. He wants me to be a hitman and whack this individual. Okay, whack means kill. And he says that if you don't whack this individual, I'm going to whack you. Okay. So he says, so what do I do? What do I do? Self-preservation, b'chai b'hem, supposed to, you know, save yourself rather than, you know, even if it means you're going to do an aveira. So we say this particular aveira, b'chai b'hem, doesn't apply to. It's yereg b'yavor. It said, Rabba, who says that your blood is redder than the other person's blood? Who says that the my chos is the dama didacha sumak fei? Maybe his blood is considered to be redder. Okay, we'll use that definition. Maybe his blood is considered to be more valuable in the eyes of a Kodesh Baruch Hu than yourself. You can't go and you can't affirmatively kill another person. So the Kesef Mishnah asks, okay, I understand. You can't, you know, if I'm pitting one against one, I can't say that one person's life is going to be more valuable, that my life is going to be more valuable than somebody else's. But certainly everybody's life, the collective whole, is going to be valuable than the life of one individual. So why don't we say in that case that you should hand over an individual, even if the individual hasn't been identified, or according to, you know, Reish Lakish, if the person, you know, has been identified, but isn't Chayav Misa Kesher Ben Bichri. So why is it that you don't hand over an individual in that particular case? Kesef Mishnah says it must be that we have a Kabbalah, that once we say that you don't murder in order to save yourself, you don't murder everybody. Even he says, despite the fact that this person who would be handed over would be killed anyway, you're not allowed to engage in a case that was considered to be a low plug. It's considered to be a low plug. It could be that because we draw a juxtaposition between the case of the murder and the case of Nara Hamurasa, that we say that in the case of Nara Hamurasa, we derive from Moseach, that just like in the case of Moseach, you have to give yourself in rather than be killed. So too in the case of Nara Hamurasa, you have to give yourself in to be killed rather than to rape and have relations with a woman who's an Eishes Ish, who's a married woman. So once we have that Hekesh, so Rav Chaim Ozer Grzhensky says, so the Hekesh teaches us that we're not, just like in the case of Nara Hamurasa, we're not bounded by rules of my chazis, of this svara of who says your blood is ready. You're just not allowed to do it. So too in the case of Ritzikli, you're just not allowed to do it. It doesn't matter if the svara, if the rationale, the logic is going to dictate otherwise. Or you could say, this is a suggestion that I came up with, but then I saw that others also came up with this suggestion as well, that even with one individual, we say that that if you kill one Jew, it's considered like you killed an entire universe. Like we said, when Cain killed Hevel, he was told, that you're not just killing one person. You're killing every person as a universe unto himself. So you're killing one unit, you're killing one infinity. Basically, to save other infinities, it's all considered to be an infinity. It's still a Maichuzdis type of equation. But whatever the calculation, we see that in Halacha, said the Chazon Ish, we don't say that you can kill one person in order to save five people. It would still be considered to be a Maiser Ritzich. We don't allow that as a matter of halacha. This kind of utilitarian idea that what Dr. Foote spoke about years later, that of course you follow the utilitarian approach, and most people would say that. He says, that's not the halacha. It's not what the Torah says. The Torah doesn't have this type of a notion. If you'll have to actually kill somebody, so then you're not allowed to do it. But here he says, that's when you're handing somebody over to be killed. But if you're deflecting an arrow to prevent people from being killed, and it just happens somebody else will be killed, so maybe that's considered to be a Maisa Hatzal. That's what the Chazon Ish says. And then the Chazon Ish, you know, you ever open up a Chazon Ish, he goes on for a while. He goes in many, many paragraphs, pages, you know, a long time. So, you know, who's going to read the entire Chazon Ish at once? So a lot of people. So they read up until that point in the Chazon Ish and said, oh, so Chazon Ish says that fundamentally this is considered to be a Maisa Hatzal. This is considered to be an act of rescuing, even if one person is going to end up being killed afterwards. So if you had a driver on the road, and the driver, let's say it's not an autonomous vehicle. I have a driver who's driving on the road, and that driver is about to go into one, it's about to go into five people who are in the middle of the road, but the driver can swerve out of the way, and there's one innocent, you know, fellow or woman who is standing on the side of the road. I just think I lost my Zoom connection. It's reconnecting. Okay. You have one person who's standing on the side of the road who's going to get killed. So he said, according to the Chazon Ish, you would have to divert the vehicle because you're not specifically angling to kill that person. You're not like handling over that person to be killed. You're engaged in an act of avoiding hitting the other five people. And therefore, this would be a permissible action. This would be considered to be a Maisa Hatzala. That's how there were, I think if you look in the writings of Rav Asha Weiss, he seems to understand the Chazon Ish that way. There's a Sefer Mishnas Pikuach Nefesh by Rav, I think Yosef Aryeh Lawrence, who seems to understand the Chazon Ish that way. But Tzitz Eliezer says, I looked a little bit further in the Chazon Ish. And if you go a little bit further, a couple of paragraphs down, the Chazon Ish says, well, that's one way of looking at it. On the other hand, you could look at it a different way. And the other way that you can look at it is that this case is worse. Why is this case worse than the case of giving over somebody to be killed? Because I would give over somebody to be killed. So maybe, you know, that person will be a clever, you know, resourceful person. He'll figure out how to sweet talk his captors. Maybe he'll talk them into a bribe. Maybe he'll say, oh, your shoes are untied and run out of the room. He'll come up with, you know, some way that maybe they won't kill him in the end. On the other hand, in this case, you're killing directly. You're taking that arrow, diverting the arrow in such a fashion that it is most certainly going to ream into the one person who's standing on the side. Therefore, you can argue that this is much more of a Maaser Ritzicha than the other case. Therefore, it's not at all clear that if we were dealing with a regular person, this person is on the side of the road. According to some poskim, they think that it would be permissible to swerve. And others, like the Tzitz Eliezer, said, no, absolutely, because he absolutely not. And he says that the real rationale
behind the whole case where we speak about how you're not supposed to kill somebody to engage in self-preservation, says that Tzitz Eliezer, he quotes from the Tamidei Rabbeinu Yonah in Maseches Avodah Zarah, and he says that it's based on the principle of the Shevel Tase Odif. So therefore he says that this idea of Shevel Tase Odif is operative in any situation when you can engage in Hatzalah in terms of saving one person, but it would only be at the expense of causing somebody else to be killed, that we always say Shevel Tase Odif. But then the question arose, even if that's the case, and Rabbi Bleich, who's written on this subject, also assumes that this would be the case, that we would say that even though in a perfect world, our goal would be that we want the utilitarian result. We want to minimize the number of deaths that would clearly be our desire. Nonetheless, if it can only be accomplished through an act of murdering, so that's not something that we can allow. But what if you can program in this particular fashion, meaning that you have the ability to make various algorithms? If you're the one who is programming the self-driving cars, you have the ability to program the self-driving cars in such a way that if it would be faced with this type of situation, what we call the trolley problem situation, then you can program it that it's going to swerve to hit the one person as opposed to the five people who are in the middle of the road. And the person who's in the car, the driver, does not have any responsibility to do this. The driver is sitting in the back seat, reading a book or whatever it is that the driver is doing. The driver does not have to make a decision one way or another. It is one that has been pre-programmed into the car. So here, you could make the argument that pre-programming is a totally different story. So that's what Rabbi Bleich argues. Rabbi Bleich brings a raya from a halacha that is quoted in Shulchan Aruch and Simon Shin Peches of Choshen Mishpat, based on a comment of the Nemuke Yosef in the first parak of Baba Basra, dealing with a situation where you have like a flow of water that is about to ruin somebody's field. If the person can divert that flow of water from their field before the water actually starts to go inside of their field, so they haven't yet become the victim, and they're just preventing themselves from being the victim in the first place, so that they shouldn't be one that has to suffer because of this flood that somehow has overrun the riverbanks, and they put up some type of a wall. So now the water is going to be diverted in a different direction. It's mutter to do that, despite the fact that you know that somebody else is going to eventually suffer from having their field flooded as a result of your action. So he says it's so too. If something is planned in advance, or you know that the government is planning to quarter certain soldiers in the houses of some individuals, this is what some of the posts can talk about in Maribal, and you have the ability to see to it that it not be you, or you even have the ability to intervene and see to it that it not be other people. It doesn't have to be self-preservation. You're saving certain other people. So as long as it's before they actually came into town, and you're just protecting yourself ahead of time, so that would be perfectly permissible. So, as too, says Rabbi Bleich, if the programming is taking place ahead of time, so then it makes sense that we should program the cars in such a way we're not dealing with an actual situation in front of us where the multitude, the people will be saved, and the other people who are kind of, on the side of the road, even though as a result, as a corollary of our programming, the people who weren't otherwise in danger are going to get killed, so it would seem to make sense to do that. However, this case is a little bit different because the cases that the poskim speak about in Choshen Mishpat, first of all, don't deal with murder. They don't deal, they talk about, monetary damage of various sorts. It's not dealing with actual killing. And it's also not directed towards a particular person. It's you're putting up a certain framework of a protection. That framework of protection means that maybe other people who aren't similarly protected might be in danger, but you're not affirmatively going after a particular person, even through a program, to go and target that person, even if the identity of that person is not yet known. Never mind the fact that if we're dealing with just the eyes off type of self-driving car situation where the driver still has responsibility to listen to, you know, the GPS or the recorder voice that goes off and says, uh-oh, we're in a tough spot right now. So maybe then responsibility does devolve again upon the driver. Granted, if we're in a minds-off type of model where the driver does absolutely nothing, so then, you know, maybe this becomes a little bit more pertinent. Rav Asher Weiss, in his institute, also came to a similar conclusion. At least Rav Yossi Sprung, who wrote a paper for that institute, published a paper in which he came to the same conclusion, that he felt that in this situation, it was clear that this is the way that it should be programmed. Another consideration would be, if you ask your average person, how would they want the program? How would they want the situation to be programmed? Most people would say, this is the assumption, that they would prefer such a program. They would prefer such a program so that the greatest number of lives would be saved, even though by agreeing to this, they're kind of putting themselves at risk. But maybe this is a situation where, for the good of the tzibur, it would be appropriate for one to put themselves in risk, at risk. Again, might not be an obligation, but, you know, perhaps a reshus at least, for them to make that type of a determination to put themselves at risk. The problem with these types of assessments is that this is not necessarily borne out. There's a certain paradox in the surveying that's been done of those who have been producing the self-driving vehicles. And the paradox goes as follows, that if you ask your average person, what type of system should be put into place? Should it be a deontological model, where we just have absolute rules? Or should it be a utilitarian model, where we want to preserve the lives of the greatest number of people? So most people would say, with respect to anybody else on the road but myself, then yes, that's the system that I want. But if I'm driving the vehicle, so then the number one principle I want to be at play is the self-preservation of the occupants of the vehicle. When you ask people, they say, you can't have both preferences at once, obviously, unless you only satisfy like one person. So yes, this person, we're going to, you know, work for their self-preservation. Everybody else, we're going to take into account utilitarian considerations. But you can't have both systems or both preferences at play with respect to every single driver on the road. So therefore, it's not really true that everybody would answer that way. If you think about it, is it obvious that everybody would feel that way? You know, one of the questions that came up with respect to the shooting down of the possible shooting down of the planes in the World Trade Center situation, they asked the question, what if it would have been possible to have shot down the planes that were going into the Twin Towers before they went in, so that you kill everybody in the plane? They were going to die anyway. And save everybody in the building. Would it have been permissible to shoot down the plane? I mean, there is one opinion that's quoted. It's a Panimiros, quoted by the Alkut Shmuel on the side of the Shulchan Aruch and Yoredei, who says, well, if the people would have died anyway, so then it would be permissible. But as I said, Chazon Ish doesn't assume that way. Kesavishan doesn't assume that way. So they assume that when it comes to not being allowed to turn somebody over to the enemy, for example, in Maaser Tzicha, that would be prohibited even if that person would be killed anyway. That's the general assumption. So then the question is, would the shooting down of the planes in the World Trade Center have constituted a Maaser Hatzala, or would it have constituted a Maaser Tzicha? So the author of the Sefer of Mishnas Pikuach Nefesh asked this question, and he said that maybe you can argue it both ways. He said, according to what the Chazon Ish said, that you can divert the arrow in order to save the five people and only kill the one person, except the Chazon Ish didn't actually say that, but that's his interpretation of the Chazon Ish. So he says, so maybe this case is worse than that, because the shooting down of the plane certainly is not, you know, diverting an arrow from killing some people. You could say, if I diverted the plane and I'm shooting the plane, that's much more of a Maaser Ritzicha. On the other hand, you could say, no, I'm not shooting the people, I'm shooting the plane. And the plane just happens to have people inside. So Rabbi Strong raised the additional. So he said, I asked Rav Chaim Kanievsky, as the Gadol Hador, and this gives you a sense as to just how circumspect we have to be about these issues, because Rav Chaim Kanievsky, who was a Sar HaTorah, Nukula Torah Kule, every single possible sheet in and out. You know, so what was his response to this? His response was, he said, Nistapaknu Mazeh. He said, gosh, I don't know. That's a tough one. That's a really tough question. That was basically his response. Nistapaknu Mazeh. So he goes further and he says that, well, certainly if you only had the Chotvim, you only had the murderers, they were on the plane, the terrorists. So for sure, then that would be an act of Hatzalah. I think that goes without saying. But let's say that you have other people who are on the plane. So can you say that the other people are rodfim? They're not rodfim because they're not, you know, intentionally out to kill the people, and they're not controlling the plane. So they're not the ones who are driving the plane into the building. So they're not even unintentional rodfim. They're not, you know, considered to be rodfim in that type of situation. But some wanted to suggest, well, if you would ask the people who are on the plane, if you would ask them and you would say, would you prefer to get shot down? Would you prefer to get shot down rather than to go into, you know, since you're going to die anyway, rather than to go into this building, what would their preference be? So some say, well, it's obvious that that would be their preference. But it's not entirely clear. That's what Rav Lawrence says. He says, well, maybe, you know, we could say that that would be their preference. But then he says, on the other hand, probably you have in the plane people who are tinokos, the katanim, you know, young children don't have das to be able to express a preference. I would say maybe you can argue in the World Trade Center case that the people on the plane would have expressed such a preference because they would die anyway. But if you had a situation where people wouldn't die anyway, or maybe you can't necessarily know you'll die. Well, it looks like the plane's going to go into the World Trade Center, but maybe the terrorists will change their mind the last second. That most people, or a lot of people, would say that they don't necessarily want to give up their lives under those circumstances. That who says that a person who is minding their own business, that they're just kind of standing on the side of the road in the sidewalk, they've observed all safety precautions. I have five drunken individuals who wander out into the middle of the street acting completely irresponsibly. So who says that your average person would say, well, in such a situation, I'd rather that the car swerve around the five irresponsible people who jumped into the middle of the street, maybe they were suicidal anyway, or whatever other problems they had, and I'm minding my own business, standing on the side of the road, I would rather get killed in that situation. Who says that a person has that preference, and who says that a person really has an obligation under those circumstances, so we should really program the cars in this particular way? Now, the Rambam talks about the case of abortion. The case of abortion is another example of this sort of tricky balance. If you have a fetus who's threatening the mother's life, so then the Mishnah Olos, we talk about how it's appropriate to kill the fetus in order, the fetus is not a full-fledged nefesh yet, not a full-fledged life, whatever you think about, you know, abortion, whether it's a prohibition of murder, or whether it's a prohibition of chavola, of maiming, you know, somebody, but even if the nature of the prohibition is ritzicha, it's murder, everyone agrees the fetus is not a full-fledged nefesh, not a full-fledged human being yet, and therefore the mother's life takes precedence, and you would kill the fetus in order to save the mother. But as soon as the fetus's head emerges, and the mother whose life is still in danger, and if you kill the fetus at that point in time, you would still be able to save the mother's life. We say that we don't save the mother's life by killing the fetus at that point in time, because ein nodochen nefesh mipnei nefesh. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, because the person is being pursued, the mother is being pursued through heaven, and therefore she has no right to decide to take the fetus's life in order to save her own life. Or we don't do that, certainly for the mother, and Pasha says she can't do it either. But the Rambam uses a different formulation than the Gemara. The Rambam's formulation is, tivo shel olam. The Rambam says that the reason why you cannot take the mother, the fetus's life, is because the child, the fetus, is simply coming out as a matter of a tivo shel olam, that this is the way of the world. You can't punish the child for the way of the world. A person who happens to be minding their own business inside of a certain city, where the terrorists want to attack the city and kill everybody, we don't say that, even though, according to Reish Lakish, who the Rambam Paskins like and the Taz Paskins like, even though the terrorists may have targeted that particular individual, we don't say that individual is a rodef. Nobody says that individual is a rodef. Maybe there are other reasons why Rabbi Yochanan says we give it over to that individual. Certainly if a person wasn't targeted, we don't give them over. You can argue, but the person is just minding their own business. It means b'nei tivo shel olam. They're not doing an act to endanger anybody. The person, similarly, who is standing on the side of the street, minding their own business, because they are standing on the sidewalk, or the railroad worker who's just, you know, kind of hammering spikes into the railroad on the side of the tracks, and now somebody's going to make an affirmative decision to go into them. What did they do to deserve that? They're not a rodef. If they're there, Nativo Shalolam. Nativo Shalolam, I don't know that we necessarily have the right to do that. There's a Tosfos in a couple of places in Shas But Tosfos says that we draw a distinction in the Yerek Val Yavor case between the two following scenarios. I have one scenario where there's a possibility of killing somebody, of you having to kill somebody or be killed yourself. So we say, my cousins, you have no right to kill somebody else. What if you don't have to kill anybody? It's just that they say that we're going to kill you unless you allow yourself to be hurdled on top of a small baby, and as a result, the baby will be killed. You don't have to kill the baby. We're going to throw you on top of the baby. The person will become the chetz. They'll become the missile. Do we say they have to give themselves up to be killed in such a case? Tosfos says no. Tosfos says there's no. That's not an act of murder. You don't have to give yourself up when you're only sort of in a passive type of situation, and as a result, people are going to get killed. According to that, now it's true. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, in his commentary to the Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, says the Rambam didn't necessarily hold that way. But the Rambam, again, that's talking about not a situation where the person is being asked to be a vehicle in a Maaser Ritzicha. In this case, the person's not even being asked to be a vehicle in a Maaser Ritzicha. They're basically just being asked to agree to some type of a programming, or that we're going on our own to decide on a type of programming where we're going to target an innocent individual standing on the side of the road, doing absolutely nothing wrong, observing all the safety precautions in order to save five other people in the middle of the road. So all that I would, say is sort of like a conclusion to this discussion analysis is that I would leave that as a tzarachiyun. I think it's a real tzarachiyun gadol. I leave it, obviously, the Gedolei Rabbanim and Poskim to, issue the final word and final judgment in this matter, but I don't think it's so simple. Go back to, the original proposition that this is the parsha of Bitzilu Eidah, especially during this period of the 3 weeks. It's a time to, think about, the restoration of the Beis HaMikdash. One way to do that is by thinking about each other and, restoring all of the Abbas Chinam that we need to have in order to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Certainly, if we all think, about at the forefront of our minds, what can we do for purposes of Hatzolah, for, saving the greatest amount of people in Klal Yisrael and doing it in a humane fashion in accordance with the principles of the Torah. So, Mietz Hashem, this should lead, Bekarov to B.S. Gold Tzedek M'Heira B'Yameinu.